Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Welcome to Nature Now as another dry week begins. This is Mary Robson, and I came across a weather source that said, above average precipitation for October. Where were those people when they made that? Alas, we are continuing a pattern of dark skies because of smoke and no rain clouds. And I have noticed that even native plants that usually manage dry times are affected. I have two dead sword ferns. It takes a lot to get rid of a sword fern. They're in a place where they're on a hill, and my gosh, they look pretty much gone, and it takes a lot of dryness to end a sword fern. We have a mystery sound today, but you may not have heard this one for a while, and the clue on this one is this bird's reputation as a troublemaker is a bit overcome by its stunning feathers. That's your clue. And we are going to leap right into a discussion of feathers with Christy Lassen. She studies birds as the owner with her husband, Mark, of Wild Birds Unlimited in Squim. She's a frequent guest on Nature Now. And today we are going to share details about feathers, where they come from, because the last time we met, we talked about molting, which is where they're going. But this, here we go. My feather knowledge, by the way, comes from a book by a man named Tor Hansson, H-A-N-S-O-N, who is a local person who does a lot of writing about natural history. And his book is called Feathers, The Evolution of a Natural Miracle. And I think that's what you keep in mind the whole time that Christy and I are talking. We are talking about a natural miracle. And since the last time we talked about birds losing feathers, let's talk about how they are replaced. Say you molted out a feather. Now, what's going to happen? Starting with, how does a feather grow? So over to you, Christy.
Thank you. So feathers are interesting. They are made out of the same thing that our fingernails are made out of. It's a protein called keratin. But feathers seem to have a lot more abilities than our fingernails do. Feathers are 90% protein. A bird's feathers can make up 25% of the total protein in its entire body.
The feathers make up 25% of the total protein in the body. Wow.
Yes. Yes. Ooh. The main ingredient in growing feathers are amino acids and lipids. Lipids are fats, and most birds get these lipids from fats, oils, or waxes that they eat. A lot of these come from berries on trees and bushes. They come from the seeds that they eat in nature and seeds that people are putting in feeders. They also come, fats come from decomposing animals. Birds are part of the scavenger and breakdown process of animals that expire in nature, and the birds will eat the fats. We call it suet off of those animals and get lots of really good proteins that they need and fats from those animals.
If they do not get enough, I'm hearing you say, if they don't get enough nutrition, and we'll keep going with this, or their diet is low in proteins, they have a hard time making feathers.
They do. Feathers can come out deformed. They can come out frayed. They don't do the things that they need them to do, such as attract a mate. You know, it's really important. That really bright colored bird gets the females, you know, and it shows too that that bird is a good resource provider, that he knows how to find food. He knows where the food is. He can provide for a family, which is pretty interesting.
And very necessary for all living things.
Absolutely. Colors are interesting. The colors, the way that birds develop those colors, Red, orange, and yellows to violet colors are from carotenoid pigments. And what I learned from Audubon is that birds have to borrow these colors from plants and a few types of bacteria and fungus that they eat, that their bodies won't produce that normally. It comes from the food sources that they eat. So like our red-shafted flickers get that red shaft from the foods they eat. And we have a variant here on the peninsula too of a yellow-shafted flicker, who it's because of his diet, he gets yellow shafts instead of red, which is pretty cool too.
As you look at a bird, you are also looking at the history of what it's eating.
Definitely. Yes. Okay. I read a little bit about the birds that are mainly brown and gray, and they get those colors come from melanin and porphyrin pigments. The birds that show these colorations are mainly owls, bigger owls, nightjars, things like that. And it's a combination of melanin and porphyrins. I read that porphyrins are a structure created from amino acids that the birds have to eat. It's from the vitamins and the trace elements that birds eat. So those animals, like the owls, what they're eating, nightjars are insectivores, you know, they get that pigmentation from those food sources, which is pretty cool too.
Is it likely that an owl is black, brown, and gray because of being more invisible at night with those colors, or do we know?
I think a lot of it is through evolution, you know, that they develop camouflage for where they are living, you know, to stay safe. Sure. The way that their feathers are really interesting on owls, how they fly silently. It's a really interesting structural development of them. They actually have no sound when they fly.
They can actually seem to be floating even while they're flying.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. They are staying healthy because they can hunt better that way. There are a few more comments here that we talked about color. Blue and white.
Blue and white are interesting on birds. Yep. They are not from pigments at all, but from the structural elements of the feathers, the way that the feathers grow themselves and reflect the light.
I noticed when you see an Anna's hummingbird, a male, they will turn themselves so that they face light, and that makes that red patch on their chest so much more obvious. In that case, if the bird were not turned toward the light, you don't see that. If it's a sunny day, the male Anna's just do not wish to be facing the wrong direction. they really want to be seen.
Yep, it really shows how those feathers refract light too. Uh-huh. That, you know, when the Anna turns to the side, his gorget looks dull, almost gray or black. And then when he comes to the light, the sunlight hits it and reflects those colors back as a bright magenta. It's really beautiful.
What about a bird that might be all white? I'm thinking of the ptarmigan, which is gray and brown in the summertime, but turns all white in the winter with a few spots here and there of brown. That's probably it's basically their DNA, right?
It is, definitely. You know, it's the way that their feathers grow in seasonally so that they can stay camouflaged. And again, white is not a pigment. It's just the way that light reflects back off those feathers. So there's no actual color in there. They just look white from the way that the light reflects off of them. And their molting is interesting too, because the snow melts in the summers. And so they molt back into those brown and gray colors to blend in with the terrain and be safe.
Wow. This is just a glance at a generalization about bird feather color. And we have about one we didn't make, the green, which I think is one of the most beautiful colors on a bird. You think of a parrot or a parakeet, and maybe the tropical birds are green more often because of their environment. I don't know, but where do they get that?
So green comes from carotenoids and a melanin combination, as well as the structure of the feather. So it's a combination of all three of those elements, the foods they eat, the fats they get, and the way that their feathers grow. It's pretty interesting. And you think too, like tropical birds are so colorful. I mean, they have their show mates is they are a good provider is not because of that they can resource, they have good resources for food because food is so abundant in tropical areas. The nectar producing flowers, the fruit producing plants, things like that, they have to get super showy to attract a mate, which is really cool. Oh. And so they develop more and more colors to be more and more attractive to mates. And they have those natural resources to produce those feathers too, which is fine. Right.
And in a different climate, that would be a hindrance to be that bright colored.
Absolutely. Something they would like a sore thumb in Minnesota.
Pluck you out of the air immediately. We talked a little bit about the proteins and what birds eat and the fact that to be breeding successfully, male birds in particular need to be brightly colored. But what about the way they can live and fly in warmth and in heat? How does the feather help? In other words, it's not just the color of the feather, but the structure and where it's placed on the bird, how it works.
Well, you know, there's a lot of different types of feathers on birds. There's, you know, like the flight feathers and the contour feathers are the ones that you see the most. They're on the outsides of the birds. Those two feathers always have something underneath them as well. There's more feathers laying underneath those flight feathers and the contour feathers. But when you look at a bird, what you're seeing is their contour feathers. That's the shape of the bird itself. But there's a couple more different types of feathers too. There's down feathers, there's semi-plume. Both of those keep the birds warm. Those are feathers that help them with insulation. There's also a phyla plume and a bristle feather. And those are sensory feathers. And they're pretty cool. Like on flycatchers, you can actually see on a flycatcher's face, he has these little whiskers that stick out from his face, like a little mustache, you know, kind of whiskers. And they're sensory. Those are sensory feathers. They help him navigate. They help him get through bushes. They help him get through smaller spaces if he's looking for food, which is pretty cool.
So there's kind of an analogy with cat whiskers, which are supposed to show the cat what the dimensions of where it's trying to go are. And in this case, the bird would also be provided with those kinds of ways of being.
They are. They're little detectors on the size of his face.
I think that the statement that when you look at a bird, you're seeing a particular group of feathers called contour feathers, that is really worth noting because and when you see someone draw a bird, they're basically drawing how the contour feathers rest against the body.
Yes.
Wow. In terms of how they keep warm, I know that they can survive by fluffing up, but what's the nature of a bird temperature and what's it trying to do to stay alive?
Birds are interesting. They are like mammals. You know, they're endothermic, which means they're warm-blooded, and that they maintain their body temperature independent of the outside environment.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. This almost always means keeping themselves warmer than the outside air. And birds have quite a high natural body temperature. It's higher than ours. Their temperature usually ranges from 102 to 109 degrees. Yeah. And the way that they stay warm is with their down feathers. So they
the
do a thing that's called
underneath the contour feathers.
Underneath the contour and the flight feathers. Yeah, there's down feathers. And almost all birds have some kind of down. There's different types of down, but it gets kind of technical and kind of boring to go into all of those details. There's almost all birds have a down of some kind. Some baby birds are born with down, some are not, but there's always down in there. When birds want to stay warm, they fluff themselves up and they do a thing, it's called petilorection, which is sort of an interesting word, but it puffs themselves up. And what they do is they trap air inside the down feathers. It creates little pockets of air that are in between the bird's skin and their outer feathers, their contour and their flight feathers. Uh-huh. And their body temperature heats that air up and keeps them warm. The cold air never makes it through the outer feathers into the down feathers. Kind of like a puffer jacket, like we use our down puffer jackets.
Well, one of the reasons why down is one of the most well-regarded materials for a winter jacket. The difficulty with down, however, is that if you get it wet, you're fairly well stuck. So we might be, well, we'll be talking a little bit about how birds manage with water. But the other part of managing warmth is quite the opposite. What about when they need to cool off, which could happen often?
Definitely. And there's a couple of things that birds do. Usually there is some birds, and it seems like maybe larger birds, you see this more on, they have bare patches under their feathers that they can kind of raise those feathers up and expose, almost like raising their armpits to get some air on those to cool down the pits. There's an actual term for it. I can't remember what the term is right this second. But, oh, here, I know I can tell you. It's called apteria, those bare patches under their feathers, not their arms, because, you know, they have wings. But under their feathers, kind of like a bird's armpits, and they can lift those up and expose them to the air to move heat off of their body. They also get help by staying cool from just positioning themselves so that, like, they can either keep themselves a little more shaded from the major rays of the sun. I was reading too that birds that are black, so like our ravens and our crows, the way that light is absorbed just onto the outer feathers of those birds, the heat stays on the top, on the black feathers, and then just by sitting out somewhere where there's a slight breeze, that heat can kind of blow off the birds, which is pretty interesting too.
You mentioned also watching a Steller's jay sunbathing. I'm sure that's your term, not a scientific one, but you saw it was lying in the yard flat on its stomach?
Yep. We were out doing deliveries and saw a Steller jay just flat on the ground, wings spread out. We were like, holy cow, you know, got to check it out, make sure he's okay. Yeah. But he was just sunbathing, and this was in the summer. And then I started looking up what that was, and it's a pretty common thing that birds do. It helps kind of warm them up a little bit. It can also, if they're, you know, spread their bodies out too to get a little bit cooler perhaps. So it can do both things. And it is actually called sunbathing. They call it that in the bird world. It's sunbathing. Well, and I've actually seen pictures of barred owls doing this as well, where they'll lay flat out on the ground. And research has shown that this is a practice that helps birds stay warm, but also exposes their feathers to the sun, which helps with any kind of parasite that they have. And it also helps them to smooth out preen oil on their wings. How sunlight kills parasites and feather lice on a bird is not completely understood. But the researchers that are studying this believe that heat and ultraviolet radiation from the sun are key. I read that through Audubon. They are the people that I believe. Yes.
Well, yes. You talked a little bit about preening and why it's important. There are some people who think that this helps something like a gull to be protected from water. Is that feasible?
Yep, birds preen. Preening means the bird takes its bill at the base of its feather, it activates a little gland called a preening oil gland. But it activates a gland at the base of that feather that releases oil. And then they take their bills and they run them along the edge of their feathers, and it helps spread that oil down along the feathers. Huh. That helps them stick together to keep the warmth in between their outer layer and their skin in that downy layer. It also helps birds stay waterproof too. Birds kind of need to get in the water though to preen. So birds bathing in the winter is not an uncommon thing. Having an open water source for birds in the winter really helps them keep their feathers in good shape and stay warm. And it helps water birds stay dry and as well.
In hot weather, we talked about how they manage to keep cool. One of the things that I noted or read was that because birds can regulate both heat and cold, their ranges can be huge. So a bird like the northern flicker can live from the tropics to the Arctic. That's kind of astonishing. And that must be something that has been in bird evolution for a long, long time. Where can I live according to how my feathers work?
Right. And where's the food that I need to eat, you know, going to be abundant too? I think that that's part of it as well.
How do feathers work when you're flying? I know a lot of people have said, oh, well, we learned how to make airplanes from watching birds, which never worked. But there must be something basic about how the wings work.
Basically, they flap their wings and they steer with their tail. I mean, that's as basic as it gets. Compared to the parts of an airplane, a bird's wings act as both wing and propeller for the bird. Wow. The basal part of the wing supplies most of the supporting surface and the wing tips most of the propelling forces. I read something very interesting about that, that muscles attached to the base of each feather allow birds to move them as they need, which is pretty cool.
This means that when the bird is in flight, you'll sometimes see a bird that looks like it's riding the wind. It's flown, it's got itself up there and it's flapping. These particular feathers, the flight feathers, must have something to do also with steering. I'm not sure that I'm quite saying that right, but they use their tails to steer, right?
Tails are the main part of the steering, but it's got to come from the wings too. You know, you've got it. You definitely see some of that in there. One of the interesting things that I read about that is that when the bird moves its wings up, as it starts to fly, the feathers move apart to allow air to pass through it. And that motion of the feathers aids in their flight. The wings of birds have specialized feathers for flying called flight feathers. And the power for flight is generated by repeatedly pushing those flight feathers downward. And then upwards gives them the ability for air to pass through those feathers and then get another whoosh down.
We are on the radio, I know, but you really need to have seen Christy flying behind her desk up and down.
I talk a lot with my hands. It doesn't translate well on the radio.
Well, I wanted to add, this is a very complicated subject and there's a lot of it. I recommend the book called Feathers by Tor Hansen. And I wanted to end up with a kind of a frill, which is that for a long, long time, feathers have been used as decor for humans, partly because it was hard to get a color that wasn't ochre or brown, that you see a beautiful color on a bird feather, and then it becomes part of decor. And here is your odd fact for today, friends. There, lots and lots of feathered hats were used around 1900s, and sometimes they would just even put a whole bird on. But here's your fact. When the Titanic sank in 1912, what was the most valuable cargo on board? Not people, not diamonds, not gold, feathers. The most valuable cargo on the Titanic was feathers. They were being sent to New York for hat makers. There you have it. Tor Hansen quoted this and he said it would have been about $2.3 million in today's money. That's a lot of feathers.
So, that's a lot of feathers.
And we just have time for the Migratory Bird Act.
So Migratory Bird Act. Okay. The Migratory Bird Act was put in place in 1918, and it was done because of unregulated hunting and the sale of feathers. By this time, Labrador ducks and great auks had already become extinct from hunting and the sale of their feathers. They were soon to be joined by the passenger pigeon, the Carolina parakeet, and heath hens. The law's creation was one of the National Audubon Society's first major victories, and it occurred to combat overhunting and poaching that supplied the enormous demand for feathers to adorn women's hats.
And I also someone noted that during World War I, women's clothing simplified quite a bit, and you had less clothing on, and it was much simpler, and it became, I think, not so fashionable to have a whole head full of ostrich feathers. But any picture you see of somebody from that time wearing one of those hats, I don't know how they got through doors or stood up. So the Migratory Bird Act was put in there to help. And in conclusion, feathers, as Tor Hansen says, are nature's natural miracle. Absolutely astonishing. And there are so many things to be amazed at when we look at birds. And looking at feathers gives us another way to appreciate them. So, Christy, thank you. I really appreciate having you here. Anything you want to add as a touch at the end?
I did read a little something recently. There's an article that just came out, just an FYI for people out there, that watching birds is good for your mental health. So, as a PSA, sit in your backyard, sit in a park bench, sit in the parking lot, watch the birds in the trees for a little bit. It will make you feel good.
Well, I would think we've intuited this before, but it's good to get a repetition of it. Thank you so much, Christy. We do have a mystery sound today. And the mystery sound is the Steller's Jay. It is annoying and absolutely beautiful. The Steller's Jay lives in conifer woods along the Pacific coast, where the eastern blue jay is not present. Steller's Jays have solid black heads. Eastern blue jays have white head feathers and blue ones. And in some western areas, you may get both kinds of jays at the same time, which would make it very hard to hang on to your sandwich, I'll say that. And these two jays are the only jays that have crests. They're very, very striking birds. They are corvidae in the same family, including crows, ravens, magpies, several other species of jay. These are considered by many to be the most intelligent family of birds. And Steller's jays, which we will see here quite often, they are omnivorous. They will eat everything from seeds to spiders. They pause often to eye their surroundings, cocking their heads with sudden movements. Jays have incredible spatial memories. I really like that. And Steller's jays store surplus food in caches. They also raid the caches of Clark's nutcrackers and other birds. Thanks to all of you for being with us today. And one person summarized the Steller's Jay by saying, "They are every loud-talking, pompous, kleptomaniacal person you know, rolled into one admittedly stylish bird." So thank you for joining us today for Nature Now. Christy and Nora Petrich made this show work. And we do have some closing music, which is a very obscure group. I think they must be Norwegian from 30 years ago. They're called Moe. Their song is Birds Flying High. Again, thanks to both of you for making this show possible today. And happy trails to all of you.
Birds flying high. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Birds flying high.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.